This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Cotton Cloud Futons, a locally owned business featuring futons and mattresses, frames, covers, furnishings, and accessories which can be made with organic and recycled materials. Cotton Cloud is located at 701 Northeast Broadway in Portland. Information at 503-335-0758 or cottoncloudfutons.com.
I wish I was a mole in the ground. Yes, I wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, community-owned and operated public radio. It's Monday, March 20th. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Tammy Dean is engineering. Every Monday, the Old Mole brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the mole's point of view. That is, from the ground up. On this program, we regularly challenge and expose the malfeasance of governments and expose the ideology of our leaders as class-biased distortion of reality. We attempt to bring into focus the possibility of another reality, one grounded in the principles of equity and justice for all peoples. As I'm sure most of you are aware, yesterday marked the third anniversary of the U.S. invasion of Iraq. A huge anti-war demonstration took place here in Portland yesterday, with crowds estimated by the conservative Oregonian as being between 9 and 10,000. By contrast, the New York Times reported that despite polls showing ever-decreasing support for the war, demonstrations were generally small, only 1,000 in Times Square. What is it about Portland? Next week, we'll be discussing this Portland phenomenon on our program. Leading off today's program, Bill Resnick will be talking with the Holam Maya Atik, a Mayan women weavers co-op, currently in Portland on tour. Immediately following, due to previous schedules, Bill will interview Iman Ahmed Kamas, a journalist and member of the Code Pink delegation of Iraqi women. Kamas lives in Baghdad and has first-hand experience of the situation there. It seems it takes either the threat of a workers' revolution or some preventable workplace catastrophe to move U.S. labor policy in a progressive direction. I'm going to be talking about one such case of the latter, the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, which occurred 95 years ago on March 25th, this coming Saturday. Concluding today's program, Jan Hawk and Denise Morris, two of our movie moles, will be discussing the new film V for Vendetta, based on a comic book character. Or rather, I should say, given the art form's increasing respectability, based on a character from a graphic novel. Now here's Bill Resnick talking with the Holam Maya Atik Weavers Co-op.
Thanks, Tom. Yes, the Holam Maya Atik people are in Portland this week, especially tomorrow and Wednesday. They're going to be talking to people and showing their wonderful weavings and selling them tomorrow at Lewis and Clark at noon, and at 7 o'clock for the whole city at the St. Francis Church in the evening. We'll be talking about that more. And Wednesday, they're going to be at PSU at noon. Holam Maya Atik is a Mayan women's weavers cooperative, 300 indigenous Mayan women in 12 communities who organized the cooperative, both to get better prices for their wonderful weavings, and to join with others in Chiapas in the international struggle for fair trade globalization rather than free trade. So let me welcome to the station today Celia Ruiz. Thanks for coming from Chiapas.
Sí.
Good. And our translator, Kara Diley.
Hello. How are you doing?
We only have a few minutes. We really just want to introduce the Portland community to Holam Maya Atik. First, let's talk about some of the issues they're going to be dealing with. One of them is why free trade has been such a disaster for the indigenous and the small peasants and landless workers in Latin America. And maybe, Celia, you can introduce us to those ideas.
All right. If I could just give a really brief introduction One thing that has really caused a lot of damage in the indigenous communities in Mexico has been NAFTA, which is the free trade agreement that was passed in 94 that allowed direct competitions with indigenous farmers and multinational corporations, and it also brought in maquiladores and factories that had no environmental or social regulations. And so part of the fight has been cooperatives and other indigenous struggles. And Hello Mayatik was formed in 96 to promote fair trade and try to fight these issues. And now Celia is going to talk a little about it. Celia, ¿quieres hablar un poco del comercio justo y cómo se ayudó la cooperativa a las personas indígenas en Chiapas?
En comercio justo, pues lo que pensamos que por eso venimos hasta acá en Estados Unidos, porque queremos vender nuestras prendas así en precios justos. Lo que queremos, pues, ayudar a las mujeres también.
So she says that fair trade, that's one of the reasons they have come here to the United States, so that they'll be able to get a fair price for their work and to help the women back in Mexico, because it's very hard to sell their work in Mexico.
Invitamos también a la gente que acá en Estados Unidos, en Portland, para mañana, pues vamos a dar una plática sobre de la cooperativa, sobre de la historia de la cooperativa, que vayan la gente a comprar nuestras prendas.
So she would like to invite everyone in Portland to come tomorrow, because they're going to give a longer presentation about the history of the cooperative and how a fair trade is helping the women there. And so she invites you all to come listen to that.
Mm-hmm. How is their co-op, what is it doing for the women in Chiapas themselves and their communities? And then how do they see their promoting a model of international fair trade? Are they working with others in Mexico and around the world for indigenous communities?
¿Cómo se ayudó las mujeres mismas allá, la cooperativa en México? Y también, ¿cómo está la cooperativa trabajando con personas, otras personas en México y otras personas del mundo para la solidaridad de comercio justo?
Pues en las mujeres, pues estamos trabajando con otras personas aquí en Estados Unidos también para que se ayude en la cooperativa.
Okay, Celia says that they're working with people here in the United States to help promote the cooperative. And, yeah. ¿Y cómo se ayudó las personas en la cooperativa?
Pues la cooperativa que se ayuda, pues, cada vez cuando salimos a vender, pues si vendemos, pues lo llevamos todo el dinero en la comunidad, solamente es para directamente para las mujeres.
So she says that the cooperative is very helpful to the women in the communities, because they bring all the money that they make from these tours and all the money that they get from selling their goods abroad back to the women, directly to the women who made the work in the cooperative. So it affects them very directly.
Mm-hmm. And it's a real cooperative. People work together and plan together and learn together, I gather.
Mm-hmm. Y pregunta si es un cooperativa de verdad, porque las mujeres se trabajan juntos y se ayudan ellas mismas. Y
sí, es una cooperativa independiente.
Mm-hmm. She says, yes, it's an independent cooperative. They're the ones who formed it, and they work it themselves.
Mm-hmm. And they do the planning together and do the manage one another and work out financial details and details about investment, all the women together in the community.
Uh-huh. Y se, ¿cómo se hacen? ¿Trabajan juntos para hacer todas las decisiones y todas las mejoras de mujeres de la cooperativa?
O sea que llegan las mujeres allí en San Cristóbal a tomar sus decisiones, que cómo trabajan.
She says that the women come to San Cristóbal, which is where they have their center, and they make the decisions there together of how they're going to run the cooperative.
Mm-hmm. And they produce beautiful goods. We have to end now, but we should really tell people how they can see the beautiful work that they do and talk to people and hear see the slide presentation they have on Chiapas, as well as talk to them about their cooperative. So where is it going to be?
So let's see, we have tomorrow we're going to be at Lewis and Clark College from 12 to 2, and anyone's invited. It's at the Tamarack Lounge. And also tomorrow night we're going to be at the St. Francis Church at 7 o'clock, which is at 330 Southeast 11th Avenue in Portland, 7 p.m. Please, everyone come and support us. They have beautiful goods to sell, and come hear their story and their presentation.
Mm-hmm. And then Wednesday they're going to be at Portland State.
Right.
At noon in Smith Center in the multicultural room. Well, good. Thank you very so much for coming here and talking to us. And I look forward to seeing all of your stuff.
Yeah. Thank you for having us.
Yeah.
Dice gracias para venir acá.
No, gracias a usted también.
And thank you, Kara, for translating.
Thank you.
Right.
Thank you for having us.
Listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, community-owned and operated public radio. This is the Old Mole Variety Hour. Bill Resnick is right back with us, talking to Iman Ahmad Kamas, a Baghdad journalist.
Thanks, Tom. Iman Ahmad Kamas, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you.
Let me do a brief introduction. Imad Kamas is a journalist, translator, human rights activist, lives in Baghdad with a husband and two daughters. Mm-hmm. She's a member of Women's Will Organization, which focuses on defining and defending women's rights in Iraq. She'll be talking tonight at the First Unitarian Church. We'll give you all the information. Imad Kamas, you and many other Iraqis are calling for the withdrawal of all foreign troops, particularly, of course, the United States and Britain. And I guess that's based on the idea that, and your conviction, that Iraqis can be convinced to end the killing, the various militia death squads, and negotiate amongst themselves. That's in the Women's Call for Peace, I know that you're a part of. Tell us about those ideas, and why do you think that strategy would succeed of forcing U.S. withdrawal?
Well, why not? I mean, we are Iraqis, and this is our country, and these kinds of problems, you know, the whole conflicts and armed people and the killings happened in Iraq because and since the occupation was on Iraq, since 3 years ago. Before that, we didn't have any kind of these conflicts and these killings. So this is one thing. Second,
you didn't have that sectarian violence. That was not part of Iraqi life.
At all, never. Not only before the war, and through the history of Iraq, in the 6,000 years of the history of Iraq, we never had sectarian or religious or ethnic conflicts between the people, I mean, between the Iraqis. We lived together. We marry each other from different sects, from different ethnic groups. All of us, we don't have this kind of sensitivity.
You know, there are a variety of, you talk about Shiites and Sunnis. In fact, there are a large variety of people with slightly different cultures and religious convictions.
We have at least four religions in Iraq. We have Muslims, we have Christians, we have Sabians, and we have Yazidis. And there are others that I don't know about. And there are Kurds and Arabs, and we have Turkoman, and we have Armenian, and we have different...
Yeah, you had a long-standing Jewish community until quite recently.
Yes, exactly. And we live together, and even till this moment, the Iraqis are not killing each other, I mean, the people of Iraq... I mean, the teachers, the doctors, the businessmen, the Iraqi people, they don't have any problem with each other, you know, according to their sects. These people who are holding the guns and killing, these are the militias. These are militias that are part of political parties who are using religion and sectarian issues to motivate people. These are not Iraqi, I mean, not Iraqi civilians. They are armed men, militias, who are... So that the conflict actually is political. It is not mm-hmm. religious. It is not ethnical. It is political, and actually not even political. It is a conflict for interests, personal interests, for whatever, for their own, these people who are fighting their own interests, not for Iraq. And they are...
It's sort of warlordism. Yes,
exactly. And thanks to the American that these people have the chance now to have guns and to fight each other and to kill civilians in the process.
Mm-hmm. How did the warlords get their start? It's fairly recent, it seems to me, that those formations began. How did that all... I mean, it wasn't historical in Iraq. It's clearly very, very recent. How did it happen?
Yes, actually, until the occupation and the fall of Baghdad, we don't have militias. No one would even dare to think of having militias in Iraq because there was security in the past, there was law, there was a state, there was authority. No matter what kind of authority we have.
It was a brutal authority, but there certainly yes. were no militias permitted.
Well, yeah. I don't. Now it is more brutal, but we didn't have democracy. That's true. We didn't have a free speech. That's true. But now we don't have democracy. We don't have a freedom. But at the same time, we don't have security. We don't. I mean, we have the freedom to die. We have the freedom to be killed. We have the freedom. That's it. And if you are killed. Your family has the right to talk about you were killed by the American soldiers. Is this the democracy that we need? So anyway, we didn't have these kind of things in the past,
mm-hmm.
and we didn't have freedom of speech. That's true.
Yeah.
But at least we were safe. We felt safe. We are not going to be killed by our neighbors or somebody who we don't know, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, these militias are making our life hell. And in addition to the American troops, in addition to the Iraqi police, in addition to the Iraqi army, and in addition to different kinds of strange people, intelligence, arms. Iraq is the Iraqi men, and the Iraq is now heavily armed with light arms, but they are killing people.
Yeah, also sort of just mafia groups and thug groups of various kinds.
The gangs, because there is no authority, because there is no police. The police is busy... killing and arresting what they call the terrorists, and they are leaving the gangs alone, and the gangs are kidnapping and killing and stealing, and there is a very huge security vacuum, authority vacuum in Iraq for the last 3 years.
Mm-hmm. How did these the militias arise, like the Badr militia? It's very recent, but it seems to me it did begin under Saddam Hussein, actually, because he needed to pay off and to cultivate. He was losing the support of the people, so he himself set up these, right, and subsidized a lot of these sort of, you know, once obscure clerics, giving them power.
No. I mean, this is not I don't think so. Not completely. I mean, for example, the militia you just mentioned, these people were not inside Iraq. They were in Iran. And they were trained and funded and paid by inside Iran. They came to Iraq after the occupation. And they were in Iran since the 80s, since, you know, the war. Remember the war
mm-hmm.
with Iraq-Iran? And these are the same people who were controlling the prisoner of war, the prisons of war, you know, the Iraqi prisoners of war. There were thousands of them in Iran. These people, they are the people who run the prisons inside Iran, the prisons that had the Iraqi prisoners, the prisoners of war, you know, the soldiers and the officers, etc. So they have actually these Shia militias all of them were outside Iraq, were in Iran. And they were, you know, training and etc. There are other, I am not, well, to be, I mean, to be objective, I mean, not only the Shia militias, there are Sunni militias also.
Mm-hmm.
And these people are now, some of them fight the occupation because it is occupation, but there are groups of them who are religious extremists. They want to create Islamic state, and they have this opportunity now under the occupation, because as I said, there is an authority vacuum. So they are working on creating this state. So that we have militias on both sides, and some of them have the authority now, as you know, by the last election, and some of them they are fighting these authorities, and saying that they are, against these foreigners who are in Iraq. But in the end, these militias never existed in Iraq before the war.
Mm-hmm.
No one, I mean, in the past, and under Saddam Hussein regime, no one would even think of holding a gun. Of course, except if he is with the government. He is an official, we had the security forces in Iraq in the past. But apart from that, no one would dare to hold a gun.
Mm-hmm. This is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon. Bill Resnick here talking to Iman Ahmed Kamas, who's a women's rights investigator, journalist, and activist in Iraq, now visiting the United States. We've been talking about the very, basically, that Iraq was... even though in the face of sort of the U.S. impression that Iraq was a, sort of a tribal state and mired in ancient backwardness. In fact, a lot of the struggles now and the militias now and the killing now is very, very recent origins. And that, as she pointed out, Sunnis and Shiites and many other religious groups lived in relative peace until fairly recently. Imad Kamas, my sense is that prior to Saddam Hussein's seizure of power, there was really interesting political developments in Iraq as well. Highly educated people, large labor union confederations, women's groups, universities, particularly a large group of teachers, were making an effort to build a democratic government that would, in fact, also use the oil wealth of Iraq to actually develop the country and to develop the infrastructure to provide more education and to build a democratic state. Whatever happened to those groups? I mean, they were tremendously powerful prior to Saddam Hussein.
Yes, we used to have all kinds of unions and syndicates. Actually, we have unions for every kind of occupation or profession: teachers, pharmacists, doctors, lawyers, labor. Workers.
Especially the oil workers.
Especially yeah.
Railroad workers.
The strongest trade unions and syndicates are in the south and in the north. Oil companies. These are the biggest in Iraq, and after they were nationalized, and the unions are the strongest actually in Iraq. We're the strongest in Iraq. The biggest criticism to these, and we had of course the big women federation that had branches all over Iraq, thousands and thousands of branches and women and projects, these kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
But the biggest criticism to all these unions is that they were a facade of the Baath party.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, they were accused of being branches actually of the party and under the name of trade unions. But they were doing good job. This is a fact. I mean, for example, the Women Federation, it is accused of being a Baath facade. It's accused of corruption. It's accused of huge money, etc., etc. But they were doing... For example, I remember there was a very big, big project. It is called the Rural Net, which is a net of a project all over Iraq in the desert, in the rural areas, you know. And it was health and education project for women, and they have illiteracy. For example, in Iraq, in the 80s, Iraq won the UNESCO award.
UNESCO, yeah.
UNESCO, yes. UNESCO award for eliminating illiteracy. That was in the 80s. Iraq won this prize or this award in the third world, in the developing countries. And we had a beautiful and very good health system, etc. This kind of social and economic development, they were going on very well until actually the Iranian war. Things began to deteriorate after that. Now, these unions, they were big, they were strong, they were working, etc. After the occupation, they were all banned. They were dissolved and banned. And the American authorities said that these unions were not elected and they are illegitimate, and they called upon the Iraqi people to create new unions or syndicates organizations. Now,
they brought in their own, like in the women's movement, a lot of it was somehow brought into Iraq as a...
That's very correct. That's absolutely. I mean, you know that the Iraqi Federation was the only women organization in Iraq. This was, of course, very bad. There were not any other organizations that were allowed. Any group of women who want to create an organization, the Women Federation in Iraq would ask them, why don't you come with us and do whatever you want to do? Why don't you do your programs through the Iraqi Women Federation? And they were, other women organized, but they were not simply allowed. You have to work as a woman through the Women Federation. Now, this federation is banned, and the office, they have a very big building, is now taken. And we have now many, and I think hundreds of women organizations. Many of them actually were created here in the U.S. before, something like 6 months before the occupation of Iraq, before the invasion. There were training courses and there were networking here in the U.S. for Iraqi women. They were created here, and actually they were created and funded and trained by the American government, by the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, the State Department, and USAID, this kind of projects.
They were trying to foist sort of American-sponsored and controlled organizations on the Iraqi people as if they were grassroots organizations. But I gather that has not worked.
That's what happened. These women, they came to Iraq directly after the occupation, and they had conferences and meetings inside Iraq in Baghdad. I live rather near these places, and I see their conferences and meetings, and I attended some of them, actually. I was invited. When these women came to Iraq, they invited me to attend these, and I went, and I participated. But then I found out that this is, I cannot be part of this game, simply because, first of all, they are connected to the political agenda of the occupation. Second, because they are funded by the occupation, and this is very dangerous in Iraq, because if you work in such organizations, you are going to be branded collaborator, and this is very dangerous. And the third, because they are not real organizations. They are not their projects, as I said, are promoting the political agenda of the occupation. I would not be part of this kind. Mm-hmm. For example, they would arrange or do a conference or a big meeting for women, for example, what happened last year in the Dead Sea. They arranged for a very big meeting for 150 Iraqi women, and they are supposed to be leaders of the women movement. And they met in the Dead Sea in a five-star hotel. And I think the budget of that meeting or that conference was $500,000. And they had very big security, etc., these kind of details. And when I asked one of them, when they returned back, what did you do in this conference? What did you discuss, women issues? She said, no, we did not discuss women issues. We discussed the new constitution and federalism. Mm-hmm. And both of these things are on the agendas of the political process sponsored and done by the American authorities.
Right. Emin Ahmed Kamas. Let me do a station ID. This is KABU 90.7 FM. Bill Resnick for the Old Mole talking to Emin Ahmed Kamas, a women's rights activist from Iraq. Emin Kamas, we only have a couple of minutes left. Why are you confident that if international, in particular the U.S. progressive forces, keep organizing and force the U.S. out, that Iraqis are going to be able to, maybe with a small international peacekeeping force, temporary, why are you confident that you'd be able to solve your problems, sort of reconcile and create a democratic state?
And why wouldn't I? I mean, the Iraqis have governed themselves and they have managed their country for thousands of years. It is the occupation that destroyed Iraq, and it is the occupation that made Iraq in the mess that it is in, the chaos and everything, and the killing. It is because of the occupation. I am confident of that, because this deterioration in our life is because of the and after the occupation. So logically, if these troops pull out of Iraq, if the American president, Mr. Bush, announces that the occupation is going to end in 2 months, in 3 months, in whatever, I think this is going to be very, very useful for the Iraqi people, because these people who are fighting the occupation will put the arms down when Bush announces that the occupation is going to be ended. And then they can work out a plan to manage, to run the country temporarily until there is a proper election and there is a proper government. And of course, the American has to, as I said, has to give some room to the international community, to the UN, to the peacekeeping forces. This kind of, I mean, if they want to create, or if they want to work out a plan, it is not impossible. On the contrary, it is impossible for the situation to go on like it is going on now. This is the impossible situation. I hope that the American authorities understand this, that their mere existence there is creating violence and is provoking violence, because they are targeted as far as they are there, and they are going to fight back, and the Iraqi people are killed in the process, and the country is destroyed in the process.
Emin Ahmed Kamas, thanks a lot for talking to us. Keep up the good work. I hope when you return to Iraq that your groups are going to prevail. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Right. So long.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, community-owned and operated public radio. It seems that it takes the threat of a workers' revolution or some preventable workplace catastrophe to move U.S. labor laws in a progressive direction. The Haymarket strike on May 1, 1886 is one of many examples of the former, which ultimately led to the 8-hour workday. The Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, which occurred 96 years ago this coming Saturday, March 25th, is an example of the latter. 275 young women started to collect their belongings as they were leaving work at 4:45 p.m. on that Saturday of 1911, March 25th, when a fire broke out. Within 20 minutes, some of these young women's charred bodies were lined up along the east side of Green Street. Those who flung themselves from the ninth floor were merely covered with tarpaulins where they hit the concrete. The Bellevue morgue was overrun with bodies, and a makeshift morgue was set up on the adjoining pier on the East River. Hundreds of parents and family members came to identify their lost loved ones. 146 employees of the Triangle Shirtwaist Company were dead, were dead that night. The horror of their deaths led to numerous changes in occupational safety standards that, when enforced, attempt to ensure the safety of workers today. At the time of the fire, the only safety measures available for the workers were 27 buckets of water and a fire escape that would collapse when people tried to use it. Most of the doors were locked, and those that were not locked only opened inwards and were effectively held shut by the onrush of workers trying to escape. As the clothing materials fed the fire, workers tried to escape any way they could. 25 young women flung themselves down the elevator shaft trying to escape the fire. Their bodies rained blood and coins down onto the employees who made it into the elevator cars. Engine Company 72 and 33 were the first on the scene. To add to the already bleak situation, the water streams from their hoses could not reach the seventh floor. Their ladders could only reach between the sixth and seventh floor. 19 bodies were found charred against the locked doors. 25 bodies were found huddled in a cloakroom. These deaths, although horrible, were not what changed the feelings toward government regulation. Upon finding that they could not use the doors to the Triangle Shirtwaist Company, the young women, aged mostly between 13 and 23 years of age, jumped 9 stories to their death. One after another, they jumped to their deaths on the concrete over 100 feet below. Sometimes the young women jumped 3 and 4 at a time. Onlookers watched in horror as body after body fell to the earth. The bodies of these teenage girls lined the street below. Blankets that would-be rescuers futilely used to catch them ripped at the weight and speed the bodies were falling. Fire department blankets were ripped when multiple young women tried to jump into them. Some tried to jump to the ladders that could not reach the 9th floor. None reached them. The fire escape in the rear of the building collapsed and trapped the employees even more. Many people were outraged at the tragedy. The Triangle Shirtwaist Fire helped to solidify support for workers' unions like the International Ladies Garment Workers Union. The owners of the factory, Isaac Harris and Max Blanc, were tried for manslaughter but were acquitted in 1914. Though most people were disgusted with what had happened, there were no regulations in effect that would have saved lives. The Triangle Shirtwaist Fire of 1911 still remains one of the most vivid and horrid tragedies that changed American labor unions and labor laws. The fire had come only 5 years after Upton Sinclair published his book, The Jungle, which detailed the plight of the workers at a meatpacker's plant. But instead of creating a movement to reform the working conditions of the meatpackers, most people wanted to reform the health and safety regulations on food. The tragic death of 146 young women, whose average age was 19, was needed before the politicians recognized the need to regulate safety in the workplace. The New York legislature created a commission called the Factory Commission of 1911. Senators Robert F. Wagner and Alfred E. Smith, along with Samuel Gompers, president of the American Federation of Labor, headed the commission. One of the most significant results of this commission was the creation of the Fire Prevention Division as part of the fire department. Restrictions were made to prevent fires from happening and to prevent the blockage of escape routes. The workers didn't even use the regular doors to leave the factory. There was a man there searching because the owners were afraid something would be taken, so that door was always locked. Even the doors that were not locked were of no use to the workers. They all opened inward. When the young women tried to escape through the doors, those in front could not open the doors because of all those pushing from behind. Under the new safety legislation, factories would be required to make all doors open outward. At the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, some of the doors were locked. Usually the doors were locked so that clothing could not be stolen through unwatched doors. All doors would remain unlocked during business hours in accordance with the new regulations. Sprinkler systems must be installed if a company employs more than 25 people above ground level. Today, there are many laws that govern the condition of workplaces. Among those regulations are implemented to let people out during a fire. Multiple fire exits, unblocked fire doors, and clear pathways to exits are all required. Firefighting equipment must be maintained in the building. Fire sprinklers for higher floors and portable fire extinguishers. Emergency evacuation plans are also required in writing and posted. Written fire prevention plans must also be available. All areas that are fire hazards or contain equipment or chemicals that could start fires must be maintained and controlled at all times. The United States Department of Labor classified this set of standards as the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, in other words, OSHA standards. The Triangle Shirtwaist Fire of 1911 would change the regulation by government of business. Before the fire, government had mostly stayed away from business, feeling it had no power to legislate it. After the fire, government could not avoid instituting laws to protect the workers. Once the New York legislature enacted safety laws, other states in the U.S. followed suit. Workers also began to look towards unions to voice their concerns over safety and pay. Samuel Gompers of the AFL has won a lot of trust and admiration by sitting on the Factory Commission of 1911. The International Ladies Garment Workers Union also won support and led a march of 100,000 to tell the New York legislature to move into action. The Triangle Shirtwaist Fire remains as a turning point in U.S. history. Countless state and federal laws were enacted because of this incident. Unions gained numerous new workers who wanted someone to fight for their safety. Now employers in the U.S. have a clear set of guidelines that they need to follow to ensure the safety of their employees. It seems at a minimum that in the past, through the continuing struggles and tragedies of working people, the U.S. government could find the resolve to address abusive, unjust, and grievously exploitive practices. In looking at some of our more recent tragedies, such as Hurricane Katrina and 9/11, one has to question whether our government still has the resolve to do anything constructive at all. Now in our studio are the movie moles Jan Hocken and Denise Morris, talking about the movie V for Vendetta and the very difficult and problematic subject of violent revolution.
It is the year 2020, and England is a police state ruled by Chancellor Sutler, played by John Hurt, a fear-mongering, gay-bashing, Islam-hating dictator who strips citizens of their civil rights and religious freedoms in exchange for protection from bioweapons of mass destruction and, of course, terrorists. Set in this futuristic landscape of totalitarian Britain, V for Vendetta tells the story of a mild-mannered young woman named Evie, played by Natalie Portman, who is rescued from a life-and-death situation by a masked vigilante known only as V. V, played by Hugo Weaving, is a charismatic and highly skilled man in the art of combat and deception. V's first target is the media, not coincidentally the place where Evie works. He hijacks Britain's major news network and telecasts himself across the land. V tells his fellow citizens there is something terribly wrong with their country and urges them to rise up against tyranny and oppression. Evie emerges as V's unlikely ally in the culmination of his plot to blow up the parliament and bring freedom and justice back to a society fraught with cruelty and corruption. The source of this tale is the 1989 graphic novel illustrated by David Lloyd and written by Alan Moore. The film was created by the Wachowski brothers, famous for their Matrix trilogy, and directed by James McTeague. V for Vendetta is a dystopia in the Orwellian tradition. Big institutions control our lives. Lies are told to cover up the truth. But for V, the truth is to be found behind the mask, and we have all been wearing our masks for far too long. The film begins with a return to the 17th century and the plot by Catholic dissident Guy Fawkes to blow up the parliament. And from there, and actually I said that V's first target was the media, but there is another target in between, which is the blowing up of the Old Bailey, the courthouse. So, and Jan, you did a little research on the history of Guy.
Well, this film has been trashed, passionately trashed by lots of progressive reviewers, and rather than reviewing the various critiques, I think it would be interesting to take up the question by a New York Times reviewer, Manola Dargis, who concludes his review by saying, "The more valid question is how anyone who isn't 14 years old or under could possibly mistake a corporate bread and circus entertainment like this for something subversive." And just as Guy Fox Day is for some a joke and for others a memory that's been lost of a subversive kind of early anarchist act, similarly, this film is seen as for some a big joke, kind of a hyper-bloated, pseudo-radical film, and for others has the kernels of something important to it. And I think that initially this film, it starts in a somewhat pompous way, remember Guy Fawkes Day, and the question is, okay, well, what are we supposed to remember? So the film will tell us what it is we're supposed to remember, and throughout the film, I think there are various interventions around memory, loss of memory. People have lost the memory of an earlier time of radical resistance. There is, I think, beyond the fascist regime that has captured everybody into a state of zombieism, where people just simply sit in front of their televisions. Periodically, you have this memory of an earlier radical time that the young can't quite remember, and that's often a kind of a political part of political rhetoric now, is the call to remember and not to forget. And I thought it was interesting that leaking in periodically of a time when it was set in 2020, and that there had been 20 years prior a time when the American wars had gotten out of control, and many had organized to resist the state, and then the young had forgotten this time and had collapsed into a kind of a state of being hypnotized by the fascist state. And then there's this call to awaken and remember. But, of course, it's not clear because it's based on these kind of comic book superhero figures and a superheroine figure, what it is that we're expected to remember and whether what the film remembers is worth remembering.
It's what comes to mind for me is that, you know, I think one indication of the problems at work here is that Alan Moore, the writer of the graphic novel V for Vendetta, or V, I believe, removed his name from the film credits and didn't really want anything to do with the film at all.
That it was a Hollywood ripoff,
yeah,
of radical pop culture,
right? And that my sense is that what was missed. Or maybe one of two things could have happened. The filmmakers could have tried to maybe take up some of the tradition of British satire that is believed to be in that comic and in the graphic novel.
Because it was a critique of Thatcherism of the 1980s, and apparently quite pointed in that way and lampooning Thatcherism.
Right, and we only get a small taste of that in the film, and it's very contained, and we don't get to. I think the film takes itself too seriously, and maybe a true rendition or something that was more taking up British sensibilities would have had more humor and would have used that a little bit better to kind of tone down the self-righteous quality that's there. I think on the other hand, even to take up some of American pop culture, you mentioned that the Evie character is somewhat like a Patty Hearst, and to try to do something with some of what American audiences recognize as our pop political traditions. And so there may be some missed opportunities on both ends. But
although it did have a female protagonist who goes through a transformation, that's often a criterion for, I think, a lot of feminist film critics is, or for people in general who are interested in how people who've been in a minority position are brought into films. It's not just having a woman there or a bunch of women. It's, well, what happens to the women? Are they just there as vehicles for a male transformation, which is the kind of classical role of women in films, is just they stand for something, but they're not really fully developed characters. And I think she was. The female protagonist, Evie, which is sort of like baby Eve coming out of the garden of Eden and innocence, and she has a kind of moral awakening, and she is transformed. And I thought that some of the critics were too harsh with her and her baby fake British voice. But on the other hand, she goes through a process where she has to overcome her fear. Her parents were radicals, they were activists, and she's too scared to act. Although it then ends with this kind of hyper-individualistic stance towards radical politics, as though each of us must just simply heroically confront our fears and not be so scared to be in jail and to be tortured. And if we can somehow confront that, we'll be able to resist. But if you take her as more, less of an individual, more as a prototype or a symbol of all of us, then it's less individualistic. But I thought there was some merit in what the film did with her character.
Yeah, the individualistic act is, you know, does seem to have that, follow that Hollywood convention of one person acts. There is One of the better scenes in the film is in, you know, prior to this climactic event where people flood the streets. So the question is, where did these people come from? Because as you mentioned, there's a lot of seeing people, the British citizens, sitting in front of their televisions and consuming culture through the media, which is shown to be outwardly lying, not even just kind of shaping the news, but just fabricating it in that, you know, Orwellian sense.
In a way that was not too far off with the spins we're getting these days on wars and how everything gets kind of shifted in a way that makes the state look unassailably strong.
But the question becomes, Evie is one character who has a connection to violence because her parents were victims of violence. They were radicals and they were tortured and killed. What about the rest of the citizens? Where do these people come from and how do they understand the acts of violence that are said to be to carry some hope and the possibility of revolution? And that's partly where what the film is struggling with is this idea that violence is a tool that can bring people to a revolutionary place. And so there's a difficulty there in understanding how the general citizens will kind of react. And then again, we're dealing with very symbolic targets, the government, the media, the church, the courts, there are these targets that are taken vengeance upon.
In the same way that the terrorists, the bombings in the U.S. on 9/11 were, you know, the Pentagon, the World Trade Tower, and that's the third goal of the White House. So it's not just always random violence in the streets. This drew out the symbols of power and the centers of power that often are the targets.
Right. There are some interesting, definitely attempts to draw connections between those who act in official capacity and also have corporate ties. I mean, we should add corporations into the mix because there's one character doubles as a big media figure, but he also has strong corporate ties to pharmaceutical companies, and there's this issue of people being experimented on. And
And then the religious right is the kind of moral arm of the state. All of the elements are there that we recognize as forces of repression that would make for a potentially radical film. But it seemed to me that there were these kind of two lines of argument around violence that are not taken and were just kind of opened up here in a kind of comic book limited way. But the one argument for political violence is to kind of show the vulnerability of these centers of power. And that seemed to be part of the final rationale for violence. As the lever to blow up the building, the parliament was handed to the young woman, Evie, should she or not. And it's to show, give people hope that the institutions of power are not so impenetrable, that you can blow them up at these, and that they're vulnerable to the forces of resistance. And then the other argument in the film for violence seemed to be to awaken people from a state of zombieism. And that seemed to be the most pressing and compelling rationale in the film, that people are are asleep and you need something to kind of blast them open. And so you have this incredible music and the fireworks going off the same time you have the bombing, the blowing up of buildings. And it is, a typical kind of, the money shot at the end once again, where people get what they want, a good show, it's a good spectacle, and people are still passive observers of it. And it's a cheap politics, and it doesn't, it doesn't even awaken people for very long because it depends on too much to keep people awake. In the same way, I think you do have on the left this notion that, well, if you just show the brutality of the state and expose violence, people will rise up. Well, that isn't enough.
No, because part of my dilemma with the film and films like this is that we are constantly shown fascism as the prototype for control over citizens, over people. And too easily, 9/11 was used to generate fear and anxiety and hostility in Americans, and that there is an enemy out there, and that enemy is upon us. And in this film, too, there seems to be this idea that there is a revolution lying in wait, and that the streets become flooded with revolutionaries, and then that they all come for the show of blowing up the parliament, and they're ready for it. There's maybe, you know, part of the issue for me is that it isn't an Orwellian vision that worries me. It is this other issue, which is that people believe that the government acts in its own best interest and can, in fact, legitimize terror and terrorism and torture and all sorts of things in the interest of keeping us okay.
Through ordinary, everyday, mundane machinations of power.
Right. Well, we're headed out. V for Vendetta with Jan Hocken, and I'm Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
That concludes the Old Mole Variety Hour for today. I'm Tom Becker. Tammy Dean is our engineer. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, community-owned and operated public radio. Stay tuned now for an hour of Persian programming to ring in the Persian New Year.
By the mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down, and I wish I was a mole in the ground.